Switchboard. Why, hey, Sunshine. Let me transfer you. Please hold. Switchboard. Why, I'm just Peachy. Thanks for asking. Please hold. Switchboard. Oh, dang. He's just stepped out of his office. Can I transfer you? Please hold. Bill! It's your wife!
Times have changed. So should your PBX. Get Virto from Vox Orion, a hosted IP PBX for your business available from only 65 Rand per user per month. For more info, SMS your name to 45678.
And we'll call you.
Welcome to Talk Central, the business technology podcast brought to you by South Africa's technology news leader at techcentral.co.za. I'm Duncan McLeod. As always, I'm here with Craig Wilson. Hi, Craig.
Hi, Duncan.
So, F&B, all the news this week, right?
It is rather, yeah. They have a big launch this morning of the update to their app that includes a new geo-payments function. It's quite an interesting little feature that I'm sure will get the other banks paying attention to, as if they weren't paying close enough attention to F&B already. It allows you to make payments to other F&B app users based on location and sort of proximity. And the idea is, you know, you can use it for small payments to friends or family or people that you've gone out for lunch with who, you know, they're picking up the bill and you're paying them their half. Or, you know, there's rather a large number of uses for it. But one of the most interesting things is that you don't actually have to be an F&B customer to receive money via it. It's an interesting move from them. What it does is if you aren't a customer, you download the app, which of course is rather clever. It gets you to play around with the app and see just how good and convenient and easy it is to use.
Very, very smart move by F&B to allow non-F&B customers to receive money on and requiring them to install the application on their smartphone, as you say, because, I mean, the first thing you see as a non-F&B customer when you fire up that application is switch to F&B.
Yeah, and all the other options and everything it supports and, the, you know, the prepaid purchases and accounts and this, you know, all the things that obviously just won't work if you're not a customer. But it's a very, very shrewd move from the bank. And what they do is if you aren't an F&B customer, you can receive payments and they store it in one of their sort of e-wallets, and then you can do a cardless withdrawal at any F&B ATM.
I presume, I haven't tried it, but I presume that means you need to type in some sort of code at an ATM.
Exactly, it sends you some sort of PIN, and this remains valid for 30 days, and you can use that to withdraw the money.
I presume the 30-day limit has got something to do with FICA or some other legislation or regulation that has to do with money laundering.
That it has to move quickly enough, yeah. Well, as I said, we asked them about that this morning at the launch, about some of the security implications and FICA implications, and they said that because they're only allowing payments out of F&B accounts, in theory, if your F&B account is FICA'd, which it has to be in the first place, then those sort of funds are trusted. Interestingly, because they mark these payments as electronic payments, if you're on one of their, and these are the bulk of their accounts, that just have a flat monthly fee and then unlimited payments, any of these sort of transfers, these person-to-person transfers, are free, which is also a nice move. So, you know, it encourages people to use the app. And I'm most interested to see when they can enable this for merchants or similar, you know, or even small businesses and small retailers, you know, little coffee shops and so on, when you can make payments that way.
Yeah, I think that's the ultimate play here. I mean, that'd be fantastic. You were mentioning to me just now that there's the neighborhoods market in Braamfontein every weekend.
Indeed.
And they don't accept credit cards there. At least I don't think they do.
No, they don't.
And, you know, it's a pain. I arrived there a couple of months ago and I didn't have any cash on me, so I had to borrow a bunch of cash.
Yeah, exactly.
From a mate of mine. And, you know, it's inconvenient. But if the merchants were using this F&B geo payment system, it's so simple. We've actually done it. Craig, you needed to borrow 50 Rand this morning.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
In cash. And so I gave you the 50 bucks and you did the transfer back using geo payments in an instant. Mm-hmm. I mean, what a pleasure. I'm going to use this thing all the time.
Well, exactly. And so am I. And, you know, it also, it's going to make people evangelical again. You know, further driving, well, you know, if you were on F&B, I could just pay you right now.
Yes.
And this sort of thing. It's a really clever move. And what I think is interesting too, and a lot of people have paid attention to, is the fact that they haven't opted to sort of push the NFC or the near field communications, which is what a lot of the other banks are talking about, at least, and trying to roll out. But, you know, I mean, I've at least got a bit of a cynical view about NFC. I feel that it just
I do too, actually.
Entrenches the status quo, because it's much like, it's very good for the card companies like MasterCard and Visa, who have gotten on this NFC bandwagon.
And for the banks.
Absolutely. But essentially, it's no different from a card. It's just that instead of a card, you're using your cell phone or, you know, tapping a card or something similar, but it doesn't really add any value to consumers. Whereas, as we've seen from having used this app already, this sort of, you know, geo-based payments or these app-to-app payments that don't require any special hardware, don't require any changes.
Except for a GPS chip on your phone.
Well, indeed. But, you know, other than that, I mean, you know, assuming that you already have, a lot of people will already have this and
yes.
that you need the app, all you needed to do is update the app.
Yeah.
And from an ease of use and an adoption uptake, you know,
it's very smart strategy,
very clever.
I mean, I wrote in my column this week, there must be millions of devices already in the South African market that support GPS, have a GPS chip in them.
Indeed.
I mean, even your most basic smartphones and even some of the high-end feature phones now have sure. GPS functionality built into them. So it makes absolute sense to go this route.
Well, it's another sensible thing about this play is that, you know, it's not just iOS, it's for Android and it's for BlackBerry.
Yeah.
And
for Nokia.
Yeah, that's true. And FMB mentioned this morning that they, you know, supporting BlackBerry was one of the key decisions and it had to be done for this because of the sheer volume of BlackBerry handsets in the market.
Yes.
And considering how prevalent and how comparatively cheap a lot of the entry-level BlackBerries are, this is really, really a compelling, you know, proposition.
Mm.
All you need to do now is, of course, be an FMB customer.
Yes.
Which is what they're hoping you'll do.
And, of course, the Windows Phone banking app should be coming soon as well. And they've been working with Microsoft for some time on developing that.
Indeed, yeah.
So true cross-platform application. But it's really cool. I mean, it's you have to be within around about 500 meters radius sure. of the other person, but that's fine. That's a vast distance, in fact, you could be in.
Indeed, I think the idea is, you could be somewhere and then walk off or walk away from each other while the one person's making the payment, and it'll in all likelihood still go through.
Yeah.
What I find interesting too is that their website, I find that their actual website isn't as nearly as pleasing.
I agree with you. I'm in the process of switching from my personal banking from Absa to FNB, but in large part because of the fee structure that FNB offers, but also because of the app. And you're right, the Absa online website, banking website, is better than FNB's.
Yeah.
It's more intuitive, it's easier to do things. I always find I'm looking for buttons on the FNB site and not 100% sure all the time where I can find something.
Absolutely. But I suppose one of the benefits is there's so little you actually need to do on the website anymore. Yeah. I do almost everything. I do all my payments through the app. The only thing really is statements and so on.
Okay.
But if you want to check if a payment's gone off, you can do that via the app. I pay all my bills via the app. Now I can transfer. You could already do basic payments and one-off payments, but now I can actually transfer to other users via the app. And this is obviously what they're driving. They've clearly decided it's more important to continue innovating and adding features to the application than to refine and overhaul the website.
Yeah.
It's certainly working.
Yeah, but you mentioned NFC just now. I think the real question here is whether this, which is actually a fairly simple technology, at the end of the day, is going to make NFC relevant.
Sure, and also, you know, yesterday we spoke briefly to a new sort of Mixit add-on called Gust, which is another geolocation-based payment system.
Very much in early development.
Yeah, that they're just testing a couple of restaurants around Stellenbosch with Mixit staff, but this is another indication. You know, we keep hearing murmurs about these payment, you know, location-based payment services that are all smartphone-based, and all they require is a download of an app. And it just seems like if these pick up enough, then NFC seems a peculiar choice. And why would you bother?
Maybe NFC will find a niche as a near-range data communication technology if you want to bump your phone against someone else to share some photos or something.
Indeed.
But as a payments system, as a banking system, I'm not so sure anymore.
And it doesn't seem any more secure either, because even in this app, you know, the payer has to put in their code, and then that authenticates in the same way it would when you signed, were you to just sign into the app normally. You know, from a security point of view, in some ways I feel it's also it's certainly as secure as NFC, where you require a PIN or whatever on your device. It's just so much easier.
Yeah, indeed. The other problem, of course, with NFC is that there aren't many NFC devices in the market.
No.
I mean, I'm using a fairly modern Android smartphone, the HTC Sensation, and it doesn't support NFC.
Yeah, neither does the iPhone 4S, which is, you know, Apple's latest offering.
Yeah.
So it's actually, you know, getting it out there is going to take some doing. And my other worry is the hardware required for merchants.
Yes.
You know, merchants will have to go and get new card machines or new NFC-enabled readers. And this is just a nightmare for everyone involved.
Whereas when FNB enables this for merchants, hopefully the iPhone, through the iPad FNB banking app will be out by then, they could simply have an iPad at the point of sale.
Yes, exactly. And just press a button. Payment.
Yeah.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Great. Cool. Well, Craig, moving along, you had some fun yesterday afternoon. We went out to Lanseria and got an aeroplane that went nowhere.
Absolutely.
And came back so that you could test the new Wireless G / Vodacom / Mango in-flight Wi-Fi service, which I believe is the first time it's been done in the Southern Hemisphere.
That's right, yeah.
But the demo didn't go so well. Not really Wireless G's fault, though.
No. And we should certainly preface it by saying that. You know, they on paper, it's a great idea. Basically, they're using satellite connectivity in the Ku band to provide an 8 megabits per second internet connection from Mango's aircraft. So they're looking to roll
it out. That's the total connection to the plane. It's not what you will get.
No, it's not what you'll get. It's the total connection, which isn't enormous. But, you know, the idea, too, is that they've limited things like YouTube and peer-to-peer downloads and high, you know, high bandwidth
and
intensity things. And, yes, no porn, because they can't tell who's going to be sitting next to you. But, you know, on paper, very nice idea. However, probably not the best idea to get 115 tech journos and general geeks and tell them to bring as many devices as they like, because, you know, I took 3 devices, someone I was sitting near had 5. You know, people thought, well, they'll just come and test everything. And even if we go on an average of 2 devices per person, and it was certainly more than that,
yes,
you know, you're looking at 230 devices trying to connect to one gateway.
How many does the gateway support? How many simultaneous connections?
They didn't say. Oh. But clearly not that many. Mm. Or clearly not 200.
Yes.
And the problem was, it just fell over. They also said they encountered various other technical issues, but there was certainly some connectivity at first. Wireless G says about 30% of people on the flight managed to get online. Unfortunately, I wasn't among those. Neither was anyone in the 5 or so rows before, in front of or behind me.
Yes.
We just simply couldn't connect. So right. I spent 2 hours on a plane where I was meant to be tweeting up a storm promoting the service, trying to connect. After about an hour, I gave up and caught up on some of my reading.
Okay.
There was just nothing for it.
Okay. We were talking,
and my conversations with the people around me.
we were talking about the potential of possibly recording this podcast yesterday while Craig was in the air and Skyping in and recording the show. While
we opted
not to do that. But I actually caught Aki Anastasiou from Talks Radio 702 on the radio yesterday, having a chat with David O'Sullivan in his afternoon drive show.
Indeed.
He called in using Skype.
And then got cut off halfway.
Well, he handed the call over to Carl von der Merwe, the CEO of Wireless G, and yeah, the call got it was actually sounding fine.
He said, yeah, the call quality was excellent. Mm. for as long as it lasted.
There was terrible latency, though, which is not to be unexpected given satellite. I mean, David O'Sullivan would ask Aki a question, and you'd hear a 2 or 3 second delay before the answer started.
Sure. A journalist next to me, his first he managed to connect very briefly, and the first sort of ping he did, he was getting a latency of up to 3.5 seconds.
Oh, wow.
But other people recorded about 1,000 milliseconds, and we were seeing different times. But, you know, in theory and in a real-world environment, the other thing is, you know, a lot of people aren't going to want to use it. If you're flying to Durban, say, unless you really, really need to be online, I think a lot of people would opt not to spend the 50 grand.
I can't see the point. I mean, Durban is a 45-minute flight. The actual usable time you have in the air where you're allowed to use your electronic gadgets is probably 25 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. But for a flight to Cape Town, if you're really going to get value out of it, or if you're flying down in the morning, back in the evening, I think 90 rand for a day's access.
I definitely use it to Cape Town because you get a good hour and a half or even slightly more of good time.
Exactly.
On the plane. Now how is this working with the Civil Aviation Authority's rules around the use of cellular on aircraft? I mean, because a lot of these devices are mobile phones that support Wi-Fi.
Indeed.
But if you put them in airplane mode, it switches off the Wi-Fi too.
Which is what I thought. Hmm. I thought this too. I thought that when you put on airplane mode, it turned off all radio communications.
Yeah.
It does turn them off all off at first, but
yes,
you can actually enable Wi-Fi.
How do you do that?
I found this on the phone. If you enable Wi-Fi, you can... It turns out, having never used it before, having never actually used airplane mode and tried to connect to something,
yes,
I found that on an iPhone and on an iPad, you could turn airplane mode on, which then killed everything, and you could then turn Wi-Fi back on.
Oh,
it just won't allow you to turn on cellular data.
Oh, I see. That's interesting.
And I gather that...
I presume it's the same on Android then.
Indeed. And it was. I checked with one of the people seated next to me. And the other... the bonus of this is that at least then there's no GSM. And I gather my understanding is that it's GSM communications that are the ones that the aviation authorities are opposed to.
Yeah.
So,
I wonder how they're really going to police... whether people put their phones into airplane mode and then switched on Wi-Fi.
We could tell this yesterday. I mean, I think if you've ever had any concerns about having a phone on and it bringing down a plane,
yes,
yesterday was a great example of those fears being unfounded.
Yes.
Because I know without doubt that there were a very large number of people who simply turned their screen off.
Did anyone have a chance to talk to the pilot about any interference he might have received?
I wonder, yes. But, you know, people around me were tweeting because there was 3G until about we got a K or two up. You know, even when we took off the ground, there was still 3G connectivity. So there were
weren't you supposed to switch that off, Craig?
Exactly. There were an awful lot of devices around me that were on during takeoff, and I'm still here to tell the tale. So I think, you know, it's the same as the telephones at petrol stations and so on. We haven't actually seen much by way of conclusive proof that it does interfere with instrumentation or that it is dangerous. Yeah. And I think yesterday was an excellent example because I bet you there were at least 50 phones and tablets that were on with full cellular connectivity during takeoff.
Yes, well, no names mentioned, but we know quite a few people who use MiFi wireless 3G routers in their luggage compartments during takeoff and landing. Just keep the phone surreptitiously, you know, under your leg or something and check your mail as the plane's taking off.
Yes, I know of a few of our peers who like to see just how late into after takeoff they can still tweet a picture.
Yes.
So I wouldn't worry too much if you forget your phone on, but I certainly wouldn't encourage it either.
Sure. Not unless you want to get thrown in jail.
No, quite.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. Anything else on that subject?
Oh, no. I just think I'd like to see it in real-world usage. You know, I'm looking forward to some of the reports from people using it. The only other problem with it that I found was that, you know, Mango, like a lot of these sort of low-cost airlines, the seats are packed together so incredibly tightly.
Mm.
It's actually quite difficult to use a laptop comfortably on it.
Yes.
You know,
but it'd be great for an iPad or a
phone. For a tablet or so on, it'd be great. Mm. But, you know, if you're actually wanting to work intensely on a laptop and really bang some work out, it's going to be a bit difficult. It's going to be nice when they roll it out to some of the larger airlines and some of the bigger commercial flights, particularly international flights. I think that's going to be exciting. You know, when you're in the air for 8 hours, then there's real value to that sort of service.
Absolutely.
But still, it's a move in the right direction, even if it does mean the potential to be annoyed by people next to you making overly large VoIP calls and so on. But,
I think it's fantastic. I mean, you fly into Europe, usually it's dead time or you're sitting there reading or watching bad TV. I usually try and do some writing, but you know, in the nature of the work, you need to be online to research and ideally to post content and keep the Tech Central business and editorial machine ticking over, and you can't really do that on a long haul flight. Do it on a long haul flight currently. So absolutely, I'm really looking forward to it. It'll be like flying to Europe, 8 productive hours of working.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think it's most exciting for what it portends rather than the actual usage for local flights.
And I'll definitely, flying down to Cape Town, I'll definitely consider flying Mango, assuming the airfares aren't ridiculously more expensive than the other airlines.
Mm, indeed.
Just simply so that I can use the Wi-Fi. And the prices are good. I mean, $50 for a single sector flight. I wasn't sure what that meant.
So the idea is, I think they're trying to future-proof it for if they happen to expand the service to sub-Saharan African flights.
Yes.
The idea is that I think the 50 rand applies to, say, 3 hours of connectivity.
Okay.
So, you know, a 3 or 3.5 or even 4 hour flight, you could still use the Mango service. And then the higher fee gives you 20 hours. The idea being that you could fly down in the morning and back in the evening and use it both ways. And
I think it's very affordable. I think it's great. I mean,
I think also, though, it's important that there's a price, because if it was just free, then you'd have lots of people hopping on it for no particularly good reason. Yes. And then the system's going to take strain.
Yes.
But by having a small fee, particularly when you've spent, you know, 800 or 1,000 rand on your flight, another 50 rand for connectivity if you really need it, isn't bad. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people will be able to just charge it to their companies anyway.
Yeah.
If they're doing it for business purposes. Yeah. So, no, I think it's a very interesting move.
Great. Well, more news on the submarine telecommunications fiber systems. We seem to be covering this almost on a daily basis.
Another week, another cable,
We had reported on the WASACE cable. I presume that's how they pronounce it, not Wasachi.
No.
the WASACE cable, which is this massive 40 terabit per second design capacity system, which is going to stretch across the South and North Atlantics, connecting South Africa to Angola, up to Nigeria, across to Florida, down to Fortaleza in Brazil, and then across from the US to Spain. So it's going to be a massive system, four fiber pair cable system, I believe, using the latest 100 gigabit per second fiber optic dense wave division multiplexing technology.
Rolls off the tongue, yeah.
Yes. Very exciting. And they've said they've put out a request for proposals for to issue a tender to a submarine cable manufacturing company, and they're expecting to award that contract in July, And then after that, obviously begin construction and have the first leg of the system, which also includes South Africa up to Nigeria and across I think to North America on that leg, in service by the first quarter of 2014, which is less than 2 years away.
Far away, yeah.
The other cable systems on this route are probably watching this with some nervousness. We obviously had the BRICS cable announcement a few weeks ago. That's the project being headed up by Andrew Mtembu. This is the cable that's going to run all the way from Vladivostok in Russia, down through China, through India, Singapore, down through Mauritius to South Africa, and across and the Atlantic to Fortaleza in Brazil, and then up to somewhere in Florida. I forget the city. Jacksonville. That's a 34,000 kilometer cable, but that's only supposed to be coming online in the second half of 2014. So it appears these WASACE guys are really pushing to get their system, their transatlantic system,
up first.
I think we've got a bit of a race on our hands here. And of course, we've got the other South African cable system called the South Atlantic Express cable system, which I forget when they're going live, but I think it's also around the 2014 timeframe. And that's going to run from Cape Town up to Angola and across to Fortaleza, and that's a 12.8 terabit per second system. So, and along with BRICS, which is 12.8 terabit per second. Sure. So you're looking at design capacities of 40 plus 12.8 plus 12.8 plus the WAC system, which is being launched officially this weekend.
It's coming on, which is Saturday.
5.12 terabits. You've got the ACE cable coming next year, which is also 5.12 terabits.
Well, I thought you made a great analogy earlier when you said that in terms of undersea cables, we've got sort of fire hydrants. The problem is the straws that are carrying it inland.
Fire hydrants landing at the coast, straws trying to carry it onward.
This is the problem. I mean, we've certainly got no shortage of capacity heading offshore, though. It's how to get to it and how to actually use it.
But the great news is there's so much investment going on there now as well. We've seen in the last week or so the news from Fiberco that they've broken ground now. They've started trenching for the Fiberco cable. I think they've started digging in the Free State and parts of Gauteng at this stage. I had an interesting conversation with Andile Nkaba, who is the chairman of Convergence Partners, which is one of the shareholders, along with Cell C and Dimension Data in the cable system. And they're going to be the first leg is going to run from Johannesburg down to East London, which is where Andile comes from. He's a big fan of the Eastern Cape, and he wants to see a lot of development in terms of technology happening in that region. I had a long conversation with him about developing e-skills in the region, and he's got some really interesting plans. And then that cable's then going to run along the coastline pretty much through Port Elizabeth and down to Cape Town. And then the second leg, they're going to build cable up to, with partners, they're going to build cable up to Durban to create another leg around the country, circle isn't the right word, but you know what I mean.
Sort of the fiber equivalent of a ring road.
An additional fiber ring in that region, and I guess connecting to cables like Seacom, which land north of Durban. So that investment in national infrastructure is happening.
Well, it's good, and it's motivated, right? Because all of these cables have a great vested interest in getting connectivity and actually getting the capacity utilized, because you can't bill for things people aren't using.
And we're seeing Dark Fiber Africa and a lot of companies building metro fiber. And we're starting to see fiber to the business, fiber to the premises starting to happen with Conduct Telecommunications, for example, which has built a fiber network in some of Johannesburg suburbs. They're busy with Rivonia. They're doing an area called Chiselhurston, and they've already done Ilovo. So the investment is starting to happen at that level. We're just not seeing fiber to the home yet.
Yes.
However, we can't really say anything about it at this stage, but next week we're hoping to get some more detail about a fiber to the home project in the Johannesburg area. So, Craig, you're going to be doing that interview, so watch out for that story next week.
Indeed.
Good. Telkom.
Interesting. Well, big news this week about the long running. We've had little snippets about the potential KT Corporation, the Korean telecoms company.
Those talks have been going on for a very long time, and we finally got an update on the likely terms of the deal. And interestingly, well, and perhaps not unsurprisingly,
terms have been somewhat revised.
Yes, reduced by almost a third from the original offer price. I forget the exact numbers, but it's about 30% reduction in the offer price as a result of the sharp decline in Telkom share price since they started negotiating this, nine months ago now. Interestingly, a precondition attached by KT Corp that they can walk away from the deal if they don't like the outcome of the current competition trial. tribunal investigation into Telkom's alleged previous anti-competitive behavior. They're facing a fine. I forget the figure. I think it was reduced by the competition authorities to in the region of R1 billion, if I recall.
Well, at least the proposed fine. We'll have to wait and see and see what the actual outcome is. But
It was originally R3.5 billion. As I understand it, if I remember correctly, it has been the quantum of that fine, maximum quantum of that fine, has been reduced quite a bit. But KT Corporation has said that they want the right to walk away from this deal if they don't like the outcome of this.
Indeed.
Of course, it could also be the fact that that was included in the statement may have been supported by Telkom as well, because this effectively puts pressure on the competition authorities. If they impose a big fine, what they're doing is effectively telling the competition authorities, if you impose a massive fine on us, we could lose this deal.
Mm. Yeah, I thought about that too. It's perhaps actually a more shrewd move than it looks at first.
By Telkom, it could be. I'm sure KT Corporation has got concerns about this. I mean, they must have.
Absolutely.
But I'm not sure Telkom would have fought particularly hard for that message not to get into the market.
I'm sure.
Given that it would probably give, it may give them some sort of negotiating leverage in terms of, or help them apply some pressure on the competition authorities to go a bit softer on them in terms of this fine, which we should be hearing news on quite soon, I think. Sad news, of course, was the death of Roy Padiachi in Ethiopia. When was it? Last Friday night,
I think. Friday night. The news broke first thing.
Saturday morning. That's right. Obviously, the former communications minister. I interviewed him many times. I found him very personable and always open and warm and willing to engage with the media, which you certainly can't say about some of his predecessors at the Department of Communications. He was shifted out of that department, I've heard, and to become Minister of Public Service and Administration, where he apparently was doing quite a good job. You hear mixed stories in the industry now about whether he was ever going to achieve anything at the Department of Communications. But we'll never know, because he left that portfolio perhaps before he had a chance to prove himself. His successor, Dina Pule, is quite feisty. I was watching her performance in Parliament yesterday at the Department of Communications budget vote, and she put up quite a fight when she was challenged by the Shadow Minister, Marion Shin, from the Democratic Alliance. I think we've discussed this on the show before, but she admits freely that she doesn't fully understand all the technical issues of the industry. But she seems to be learning quite quickly, and she's making the right sort of noises. I think she could be doing more. I think some of Marion Shin's criticisms of her were valid, and of the department generally, and of the lack of focus by national government and cabinet on ICT. But it was sad news about Roy Padiachi. I know he's been ill for quite some time. I believe he had diabetes. The last time I interviewed him, he was struggling to walk. So I think he's not been well for a while. Just amazing that he continued running a government ministry.
Absolutely.
Despite his health.
Yeah.
Craig, Stephen Blewett, you broke the story last week that Stephen Blewett, who was the executive for sales and marketing, is that right? At Ata, which is Telkom's mobile operator, has resigned. He was quite senior. He's a former CEO of Altec Autopage Cellular, which is the country's largest independent cellular service provider. I'm not sure what he's going to do next. He says he knows what he's going to be doing next, but he can't talk about it yet. He's been put on 3 months gardening leave before he starts his new job. I have my suspicions about where he's going, but
we'll have to wait and we'll bring that story
when it happens. Yeah,
when it breaks.
But,
it seems he did rather well. He was certainly well regarded in the calls I made and people I spoke to. He seemed quite well respected at Ata and. It was quite a surprise too. What was interesting was how quietly it came to light. Someone was kind enough to give us a lead about it and let us know, but it didn't seem like Ata wanted to advertise the fact. And this perhaps interesting with some of the reshuffles they've done lately. There was the position they're still looking for a CEO, and we thought that Amit Maharaj was sort of pegged for the position, but Ata seems to have other ideas about this, and they're still looking for someone for that role, and they're now of course having to look for someone to take over Blewett's role as well. It's just an interesting move. It would be interesting to see who takes on these positions.
I mean, everyone we spoke to, and you did a piece on this week, Craig, but everyone we speak to suggests to us, I mean, the guys don't want to talk on the record because because obviously they have to work with Telkom and work with ATA. But you know, everyone we speak to involved in the cellular distribution business, in the you know, anyone who interfaces with ATA, even speak to consumers, and it really seems to me that they're not doing well at all.
No, and you know, it's a pity. There was such great excitement when they launched. There was this idea of a fourth operator, hopefully drive down prices again, you know, further, and perhaps shake things up a little bit, like people like Cell C have done over the years, and really, you know, take the fight to Vodacom and MTN, the heavily entrenched incumbents.
They certainly seem to be trying in the early days. I mean, with these broadband specials and that.
These really aggressive, you know, that 10 gig special is still great. There's also the 60 gig on, 60 gig off peak. But 120 gig offering. There's a lot of very compelling products, but people just don't seem to care. They're really having trouble getting mind share more than anything, and getting people interested. And even on the sort of low end prepaid market, you know, they've certainly positioned themselves as quite a youthful brand. And what a lot of people said to me this week, which I think is very valid, is really, is this the right market to be targeting? Should they not be going after the postpaid market? Not only because the you know, you make more money off contract users than you ever will off prepaid users, but because really, ATA's greatest asset is Telkom, and the fact that it could offer converged services, you know, for fixed line and mobile, and you could get one bill for both from one company. But they just haven't seemed to capitalize on that yet, and they've been very quiet lately.
They have.
This market, especially the prepaid end of it, which they still seem to want to play in, you know, there are new specials often from the operators, and they've got to constantly jockey to sort of leapfrog each other by offering slightly better options, because the prepaid market, especially the low end, is fickle, and they will switch very easily, and that's a place you can win customers. But you know, we just haven't heard anything revolutionary out of ATA for the last couple of months. We haven't heard anything really, really compelling. And the other problem I'm hearing from some people just in casual conversation is service levels. My understanding is that they're piggybacking on Cell C for voice and data for, say, postpaid users when their network doesn't extend quite as far. But for, you know, some of the data offerings, you're only on ATA's network. And there are some people who are having connectivity problems.
Yeah, you know, Craig, I think the other problem that ATA is facing now is a certain gentleman called Alan Not Craig, who's just taken over at Cell C. And
you're not the first to say that to me this week, Duncan.
He knows the distribution game backwards. He knows this industry backwards. I'm sure the bigger players in the industry, MTN and Vodacom, are watching him with some trepidation. But here's this upstart ATA, which doesn't really know the mobile game, doesn't have a CEO who understands the... Well, they don't have a CEO right now. Not Craig is, you know, I mean, I was chatting to several people at his 60th birthday party yesterday, and the consensus was, you know, if I was ATA, I'd be absolutely terrified about what this guy's going to do.
Sure.
You know, if Cell C, as the third largest operator in the country with, what, 12% market share or so, really finds its feet under Not Craig, what space is there for ATA?
Absolutely.
Maybe Telkom's best bet would be to sell ATA to Cell C, and then sign an MVNO with them.
Sure, and roll the two together, It's funny, because also, as we said, a lot of people I spoke to said, there's no way Alan Not Craig's going to drag his feet, and this is what a lot of people seem to feel, and some people in the industry feel that ATA's doing. And they said, you've just got to be quick and really agile in this market, and you need to be constantly pushing new services and new offerings into the market, and there's no reason to believe that Cell C is going to do anything but that, that they're going to be as aggressive as possible to try and steal some of... those clients that have sat with Vodacom and MTN for years.
Yes.
And, you know, ATA's just not pushing hard enough. And they're in a very similar space, except not as successful and not as entrenched as Cell C. And if Cell C is aggressive enough, they could really completely overshadow them.
Indeed. Cool, Craig. We really are running out of time. I think very briefly, our new feature, our apps of the week.
Yes.
Have you got something for this week, Craig?
I do. Mine is an iOS-only app, but this is all right because you can cover the Android side of things. I'm hoping, I've read there is an Android version being spoken about, but it's a Twitter client. We, of course, spent quite a lot of time on Twitter, as do a lot of the journalists we encounter. And it's called TweetBot. It costs $2.99, and while I always try and angle for free apps, it's absolutely worth the outlay. It's simply the best Twitter client I've ever used. It's just really intuitive. I really want them to make a desktop version for, you know, Mac laptops and desktops, because it's the only thing that's missing from the family. They do an iPad app and they do an iPod Touch / iPhone app. And it's just really, really clever. It's really intuitive. You've got things like, if you're looking at a conversation, if you swipe one direction on it, it'll bring up a list of the conversation and show you, you know, how you got to this point, which can be one of the challenges for people who are coming, you know, to look at Twitter for the first time. And if you swipe the other way, it'll show you replies or retweets or this sort of information. And they keep adding to it. There's an update every week or two, and they just add little features. You know, like a lot of other apps, they're now doing thumbnails for video and images when people have tweeted them, so you get an idea whether you want to look at an image. If you do, it'll just pop up in the app. You don't have to go off to the third-party sites like Lockers or TwitPic to actually see the images. You can even set it now to sync between devices, so it'll leave your, you know, if you've read all your tweets on one device and you move to the other device, it won't tell you that you've still got unread tweets. It sort of syncs across them. If you hold down on the new tweet button, it will automatically open your most recent draft. Just a lot of these little touches that make navigating Twitter just that much faster.
Mm.
It's just incredibly handy. You know, it tells you all the other important things that not all the apps include, like who's following, you know, if someone's following you, if you're following them back. And then, of course, my favorite feature, which is the ability to mute hashtags. Now, you can mute them for various amounts of time. You can mute them for an hour, a couple of hours, or forever. So if you've got something that you're not interested in that some of your followers are...
Yeah, so you can mute me on a Saturday afternoon when the Sharks are playing.
Exactly. And I've muted all sorts of sporting-related hashtags. I find people who hashtag their sports very, very thoughtful human beings, because they allow me to just mute them forever. But also for other things, like, you know, I don't know about you, I follow a great deal of other journalists on Twitter.
Mm.
And every now and then you'll get an event where... half of your Twitter stream seems to be the same event, because everyone you know, or, you know, a fairly large number of the people you follow are at it.
Mm.
And I find that's really handy. You can just mute a hashtag for 2 hours. And then, you know, if it's not something pressing that you want to follow every minute of, and then read a story on it later.
Right.
And that sort of thing just helps declutter your timeline. And it's these little touches that make it my absolute first choice for Twitter apps. I really hope they make a desktop version soon and that they extend it to other platforms.
Fantastic. Great. Actually, while we're on the subject, I bought a Twitter app as well the other day called MetroTwit for Windows.
Oh, yes.
Really cool. It uses the Metro design interface that's coming in Windows 8, or mimics it. And really cool app. It's developed by a company in Australia. I think it costs around 15 Australian dollars, which is about the same as 15 American dollars, and really well worth it. So if you've got there's a free version as well, but it's supported through advertising in your stream, which is a little annoying, and also doesn't support multi-account Twitter accounts, which I have to run. So I paid $15 for the full app, but it's a fantastic program, well worth checking out. And by the way, Craig, I find it quite funny that you've got all these Twitter clients that people are buying and paying for, which Twitter doesn't make any money out of.
Indeed.
Twitter gives away all of its apps for free, TweetDeck and the official Twitter app.
And the actual, you know, the official Twitter app is very good.
Yeah.
Tweetbot's just better.
Right.
And does support multiple clients as well. I mean, multiple Twitter accounts.
Yeah. Anyway, cool. Very briefly, my pick of the day, and I run it on my iPad. It may be available on other platforms. I apologize. I didn't have a chance to check whether it was available for Android or other platforms. I think it runs on the iPhone as well, is an application called Band of the Day. Very cool little app. It just brings up a random band each day that you can and then gives you details about the band. It allows you to stream their music, watch their music videos, and it's got some text explaining what's the sort of genre they're in, and an interview with the band members, etc. It's a great way of discovering new music, and they've just released an update to the application that now works on the third generation iPad and the Retina display, and it looks absolutely gorgeous. Also introduced features where you can search through the music that they've featured in the past, search for your favorite bands, stream them, etc. So a really cool app. It's called Band of the Day, and it's certainly available in the Apple App Store, probably in Android as well, although I haven't checked.
And is it free?
It is free of charge, yeah.
Fantastic.
Good. Craig, I think that's it for the week. I think this is the first podcast we've recorded since we did our big redesign at the beginning of May.
That's true, it is.
We hope you're liking the new look. A lot of work went into it. We've been stamping out a few bugs over the last few days, but I think we've zapped most of them now. The main one is related to caching issues, which have now been sorted out. Our new Mobi site is going live in the next few days, so look out for that. Much bigger, a great improvement, I think, on what we had before. If you've got any feedback on the website, we'd love to hear from you.
Any likes or dislikes about it?
Yeah, we're quite happy to hear constructive criticism as well. So the email address to use for that is info@techcentral.co.za. That's info@techcentral.co.za. But good, yeah, Craig, I think that's definitely all the time we have for this week.
And then some.
What is today? Wednesday, unusual day to record a podcast. We usually do this on a Friday. We won't be recording one next Friday. We'll be back with our normal schedule the week thereafter. As always, if you've got any feedback, info@techcentral.co.za. From Craig and myself, until next time, cheers. Mm-hmm.